From PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, and Sandberg Media, LLC, I'm David Dalt with Things Not Seen.
I wanted to help Jews reclaim the language of love as unambiguously our own. And I also wanted to help Christians who are interested in rethinking, reimagining, re-understanding what Judaism actually is, not the caricatures of the Pharisees that maybe they were taught in Sunday school. One of my hopes is that this book might be useful fodder for some of that new thinking as well.
Things Not Seen is made possible in part through the generosity of our Patreon supporters. If you'd like to join them, please go to patreon.com/notseenradio. That's patreon.com/notseenradio. Thank you.
Welcome to Things Not Seen. I'm David Dalt. We're delighted today to welcome to the show Rabbi Shai Held. He is a theologian, educator, and author. Rabbi Held is the president, dean, and chair in Jewish thought at the Hadar Institute in New York City. He's the author of Abraham Joshua Heschel, The Call of Transcendence, and The Heart of Torah, a collection of essays on the Torah in two volumes. He lives in White Plains, New York. Today we're talking about his recent book, Judaism is About Love, Recovering the Heart of Jewish Life. Rabbi Shai Held, welcome to Things Not Seen.
Thank you for having me, David.
I want to start our conversation in a bit of an odd place. In fact, I want to start in the first chapters of the book of Genesis. And if we read through that in the creation story, we hear that God is continually creating extraordinary variety as the different animals and the different kinds of life on earth are talked about. They are talked about being created in their multifarious forms. And then On the final day of creation, we get to the creation of humanity. And it is simply presented to us that God creates the human in God's image. And it is not talked about in any kind of extraordinary variety. It simply is given as a declarative statement. I'd like to start our conversation there. And I'd love for you to begin to talk to us about how we might understand this moment in the book of Genesis and what we might derive from it as we begin to build our conversation together.
Wonderful, thank you. Well, as you note, Genesis 1 is like a hymn to biodiversity. God creates animals, and doesn't just create animals, but creates animals of every kind, creates birds of every kind, creates crawling creatures of every kind. And the Hebrew is like you hear an echo, limino, limina, liminehem. And so the astute reader, the attentive reader, is waiting when God creates humanity to hear, and God created the human being in God's image, in all its forms or in all its kinds. And I suspect that there is a kind of radical teaching there, because in all its kinds never comes. And I think Genesis 1 wants to make the claim that there are no kinds of human beings. And that's really important to Genesis, because as Genesis will go on and focus on the life and the unfolding history of a particular family. And actually, Genesis is, I think, very concerned with human diversity. But before it turns to human diversity, it first wants to establish a baseline of shared humanity. And that, I think, is really fundamental to biblical theology and to Jewish theology as well.
I really like this phrase that you're using, a radical teaching, because my listeners may know that radical can push in two ways. Radical can mean revolutionary, right? We're going to have agitation, but radical can also mean a rootedness. And so when you're talking about this, there's a sort of fundamental idea here that we shouldn't be focusing on our differences, but rather on our commonalities, on our sameness. Now, these are my words, not yours. As I say this back to you, have I got basically what you're meaning here, or would you say it in a different way?
I think I would say what you said, only to add a caveat, which is we should focus on our commonality without ever effacing what differentiates us, right? In other words, human solidarity and the human sense of being one family need not and ought not erase linguistic, cultural, geographical diversity. We are both members of particular tribes, families, communities, and part of one human family descended from Adam. And as I talk about in the book, the sages of the Talmud were really preoccupied with this idea of descent from Adam, because it essentially meant that if you push far enough up the family tree of anyone, right, you end up with the realization that we're all cousins, we're all family. That was really fundamental to their view of the world. They called that the fundamental principle of the Torah.
What I like about this, as we're talking about this concept of human solidarity, which you introduce roughly halfway through your book, Judaism is About Love, you've talked about both our commonality, but you also want to stress the particularity. And I love that you're bringing these two things in tension. And so as we begin to think about the balance of commonality and particularity, let's take this to the question of Judaism itself. Oftentimes, we hear that Judaism is a reflective of a practice, a religion, an ethnicity, all of which is tied around the kind of thought that a certain set of people are chosen, that they are set apart for a particular purpose or for a particular identity in the world. And so help us then to begin to understand how you are dealing with the question of the chosenness of the Jewish people in this balance of particularity and commonality.
Yeah, that's a very important and obviously very difficult and complex question. So let me see if I can say something brief about it that maybe is somewhat helpful. I think for the Bible, the idea of chosenness always comes along with a critique of the dangers of the idea. That is to say, already the book of Deuteronomy is obsessed with telling the Israelites, chosenness is not an excuse for triumphalism or chauvinism, or what one Bible scholar calls a superiority complex, right? On the contrary, as Deuteronomy loves to say to the Israelites, you're nothing all that special. You're really not all that. If God were choosing based on, you know, quality of character, you're pretty problematic. And by the way, some Bible scholars argue that's why Jacob, who is the namesake of the Jewish people, Israel, is such a morally complex and problematic character. Because no one could look at the life of Jacob and say, we are descended from an unequivocal saint. No one would say that. So I think kind of piece number one is that the chosenness of the Jewish people is not a declaration of the superiority of the Jewish people. And also simultaneously, the fact that God enters into a covenant with one people in no way suggests that God forgets everyone else. Now, obviously, like every religious tradition, Judaism has its better moments and its more problematic moments. And there are moments in the tradition which are frankly pretty triumphalistic. But I think it's very clear, as I talk about in the book, the way that Deuteronomy goes out of its way to talk about other peoples whom God also gave land to. God gave the land of Canaan, of Israel, to the Jewish people, and God gave other lands to other peoples. We're using the same word in Hebrew, natan, to grant, to give. So I think the chosenness question is, of course, really complex, but it's often reduced to caricature. And one of the things I try to do in the chapter on chosenness in the book is just to show how rich and complex Jewish thinking about chosenness really has historically been from the beginning.
Well, and this is something that I want to highlight for my listeners that arises at repeated points throughout your book, Judaism is About Love, where you will make a series of arguments and declarative statements. You will dig into resources and you will weave them together. And then you will step back and say, but I also recognize I could be wrong about this and that there may be other ways that we might bring these things together. And as we're setting the table for our conversation, this is another thing that I want to ask you specifically about. As we are having this conversation about Judaism based upon your wonderful and comprehensive book, Judaism is About Love, how should we think about, for want of a better phrase, let's call it intellectual modesty in the midst of this conversation?
Right. And it's an important observation because it is very important to me. I would say a couple things about it. One is, there's a wonderful phrase that has really stayed with me from the Christian theologian Delwyn Brown, who talks about how traditions are not monoliths, but multiliths. I love that term, multilith, meaning that there are many voices in a tradition, and frankly, often many cacophonous voices, many voices that can't easily be squared. And so I say in the book, if someone wanted to, I think this would reflect a kind of spiritual illness, but if someone wanted to, they could write a book about how Judaism is about hate. One could write a book about how Christianity is about hate and how Buddhism is about whatever the opposite of mindfulness might be. So I think it's important to understand what we're doing when we engage in constructing a story out of a vast canon. We are on some level reading selectively, but I hope also responsibly. And I take as a model for that, that the sages of the Talmud already debated what was the most fundamental principle of the Torah, meaning on some level they knew, to use a colloquialism of mine that is probably, I need a better way of saying this, what to read in light of what, right? What are the animating texts and the animating principles in light of which you interpret everything else? But also, if I could, just much more broadly about intellectual modesty, I would say the same thing about belief in God in general. Rather than believers standing on a pedestal and lecturing down to those who are secular, actually having human conversations about different intuitions about the world and about how the world is an ambiguous place. To borrow a phrase from the Christian philosopher John Hick, right? We live at an epistemic distance from God, right? I don't know if John Hick is probably not quoted that often anymore, but I think that's a useful phrase, epistemic distance. So I think it's important. I think I say in the introduction, in this day and age, a theologian needs to be able to imagine secularity from the inside. That's very important to me. And that means adopting a very different posture towards non-believers.
Now, as we're moving towards our first break, we've begun to introduce some terms, and I just want to make sure that listeners don't get lost in the vocabulary. So you've used two terms in particular, Torah and Talmud. And I wonder if you could briefly just give us an overview of both, not a full discourse, but just a quick comprehensive overview of what both those terms mean so that we can use them in the remainder of our conversation.
Great. So I think it's important to distinguish two uses of the word Torah. On one level, Torah refers to the five books of Moses, the Pentateuch, what Jews call the Chumash. That's the Torah. But Torah also, in the Jewish tradition, refers to the sum total of teachings that emerge from God's encounter with the Jewish people and the Jewish people's interpretation of that encounter. So Jews can talk about Torah that comes from the 19th century, although the Torah is the five books of Moses. The Talmud is the, if you will, the canonical text of the Jewish tradition, or the other canonical text of the Jewish tradition, roughly from the year 0 to 600, written by the sages, the what we call chachamim, or wise men in the Jewish tradition.
And as we're talking about the Talmud, and you say it is the core canon, for want of a better word, would the Talmud be considered scripture in the way that maybe a Christian listener would think of the Bible as scripture, or is it its own distinct class?
I think it's a hard question. I think it is its own distinct class in that you don't have, for example, the Talmud is not parallel to the New Testament in the sense that there are many different manuscript versions, all of which are in play. You know what I mean? It's not fixed scripture quite in the same way. And in fact, it is oral for hundreds of years. Another way of saying this is that the Torah of Moses is called in traditional Judaism the written Torah, and the Talmud is the oral Torah, the Torah that is passed on by the mouth. So it's a different kind of text. It's, if you will, a more dynamic text. More unfolding text, perhaps?
If you're just joining us, this is Things Not Seen. I'm David Dalt. We're delighted today to be speaking with Rabbi Shai Held. He is a theologian, educator, and author. He's the president, dean, and chair in Jewish thought at the Hadar Institute in New York City. Rabbi Held is the author of Abraham Joshua Heschel, The Call of Transcendence, and The Heart of Torah, a collection of essays on the Torah in two volumes. He lives in White Plains, New York. Today, we're talking about his recent book, Judaism is About Love, Recovering the Heart of Jewish Life. We'll be back in just a moment.
Things Not Seen is brought to you in part by Liturgical Press. Liturgical Press is a trusted publisher of resources on liturgy, scripture, theology, and spirituality. They've evolved to serve the changing needs of the Christian church, and they produce resources for pastoral leaders, teachers, engaged learners, and all leaders looking for quality books on faith and culture.
Lit Press books are available at your favorite book retailer and online at litpress.org. That's litpress.org.
Welcome back to Things Not Seen. I'm David Dalt. We're speaking today with Rabbi Shai Held. He's a theologian, educator, and author, and he is the president, dean, and chair in Jewish thought at the Hadar Institute in New York City. Today we're talking about his recent book, Judaism is About Love, Recovering the Heart of Jewish Life. Well, at the beginning of your book, Judaism is About Love, you recount an experience that you have with a student in one of your classes, where you are putting forth this thesis that is the title of your book, that fundamentally Judaism is a religion, a practice, an entire worldview where love is at the center. And a wry comment comes from one part of the room that says, that sounds an awful lot like Christianity. And I wonder if you could take us back to that moment and then help us to understand how that moment contributed to the germ seed, the genesis of your book, Judaism is About Love.
Yeah, so this scene unfolded probably almost 25 years ago. I was speaking to senior students, you know, fifth-year students at one of America's major rabbinical seminaries, and I said something like, Judaism is built on the idea that God loves us and beckons us to love God back. And then I got the response that you just mentioned, oh, that sounds a lot like Christianity to me. And I have to say, I was shocked and crestfallen at that response, because I had been thinking about the central lines of Jewish liturgy for the morning and the evening of every day, in which first we say, with vast love have you loved us, you being God, obviously. And then we say the Shema, and then we talk from Deuteronomy, and you should love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your being and with all your might. That is, God, you have loved us, and we are beckoned to love you back. And I said to the student at the time, I'm really taken aback at the extent to which we seem to have internalized the traditions of anti-Judaism that so animated the church for so long, right? It's as if we believed what they said about us. Now, I don't talk about this in the book, but maybe it's useful in this setting to mention that I had an experience maybe a year or two before where I was teaching at a conference of young religious activists. And this was as if it was 1954, which it was not, because they were divided into Jews, Catholics, and Protestants. And as I was teaching the Protestant students, at one point I said, what does Jesus say is the great commandment? And very proudly, all the hands go up, right? And one of them says, oh, loving the Lord your God and loving your neighbor. And so I say innocently, and remind me, what is Jesus quoting there? No hands go up. Dead silence. And I thought to myself, this is really interesting and troubling, right? It's as if one takes something and then essentially kicks the original owner to the side. So I wrote this book, in fact, for two audiences. One is, I wanted to help Jews reclaim the language of love as unambiguously our own. And I also wanted to help Christians who are interested in rethinking, reimagining, re-understanding what Judaism actually is. Not the caricatures of the Pharisees that maybe they were taught in Sunday school. I have a colleague, a Christian minister, who said to me, many of my colleagues say to me, I know I have to preach differently about Judaism, but I also know I have no idea how. One of my hopes is that this book might be useful fodder for some of that new thinking as well.
One of the things that I really appreciate about your book and that we will be getting into in this conversation is exactly that, how this is not simply a book about Jewish people for Jewish people, but rather it is a wonderful resource for anyone that wants to learn about the heart of Judaism. But I want to return for a moment to the illustration that you gave us. When you're talking to that group of Protestant students, and you ask about that story, which is recounted in the Christian Gospels, what is the sort of heart of the teaching? Love the Lord your God with all of your heart, your soul, and your strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. That's an example, which my listeners may not know this phrase, that is deeply and richly established in the Talmudic tradition, giving the Torah on one foot, Or in other words, summing up the whole of the teaching in one phrase that a person can both say easily but also ponder deeply. And you mentioned that no one could raise their hand to cite the source of that. I wonder if you would connect those dots for us. When Jesus is giving the Torah on one foot in that story, what is Jesus drawing from? What are the traditions and who are the sources that Jesus is drawing from?
Well, of course, love your neighbor as yourself is the apex or epicenter of Leviticus. It's Leviticus 19:18. And no less a rabbinic sage and Rabbi Akiva, perhaps the most kind of prestige-laden of the rabbinic sages, a hero of the rabbinic tradition, declares that love your neighbor as yourself is the great principle of the Torah, Klal Gadol BaTorah, the great principle which ties everything together. So there's a deep resonance there between, obviously, between what Jesus says and what Rabbi Akiva says. Then I would also add in the famous story in which the sage Hillel is asked to teach the entire Torah while his questioner stands on one foot, kind of maybe playful question. Hillel says, that which is hateful to you, do not do to anyone else. That's a negative formulation, of course, of the golden rule. But taken together, those two are really at the heart of rabbinic ethics. And you'll have many rabbinic sages of all kinds of different periods saying that interpersonal law, interpersonal guidance and teaching in Judaism is all a kind of unpacking of what it means to love your neighbor as yourself, which is really the essence.
I'm so grateful that you drew us to Leviticus 19:18. And my listeners, regardless of their background, they probably have run into the book of Leviticus in the culture wars that are going on. And it's fascinating to me that this love your neighbor as yourself comes in the heart of Leviticus, because so much else of Leviticus 19 is talking about the practical actions that one must take. Now, some of these practical actions are exclusionary. You will not allow your people to mix with other people's. You will not allow one type of grain to mix with another type of grain. But there are also things that come in Leviticus 19 that are incredibly hospitable. When the stranger is walking past your field, you must not have reaped to the edge of the field so that they will have something that they can pick so that they can be nourished on their journey. So all of this is there in the book of Leviticus. And then right there in the middle is this love your neighbor as yourself phrasing. But this brings us to something that you really deal with quite deftly in your book, Judaism is About Love. This balance between Judaism as a set of prescriptive actions versus Judaism as a kind of belief or identity. And I'd love to dig into that a little bit. How do we begin to think about that? And how does your book help us to rethink those classic, almost stereotypical divisions about Judaism is all about action and Christianity is all about the interior? Help us to think about that.
Right. So one of the things that is very important to me, and I think is really fundamental to this book, is the attempt to overcome that dichotomy, which again is unfortunately part of the history of Christian anti-Judaic stereotype, that Christianity has a robust notion of the inner life, whereas Judaism is just about external actions, rotes, the dead letter. You could think about all of the hostile ways people have of describing that. Now, Judaism is really focused on action in the sense that it is suspicious of internal states that don't manifest in the world. The example that I often give in person when I'm studying with people is, we've all met that person who can tell you how compassionate they are, but you've never seen them lift a finger for anyone, right? And at a certain point, you realize that compassion that is not manifest concretely in the world is fraudulent compassion, or is at least empty. So Judaism is focused on actions, or what I would call concrete expressions of the virtues. But that does not mean that it is not focused on those virtues. The ideal, I think, for both biblical and rabbinic Judaism, the paradigm that we strive for is external actions rooted in internal states, love manifested in acts of kindness, compassion manifested in visiting the sick, comforting the mourners, burying the dead, etc. It's never one or the other. It's on some level always both. Another way that I might formulate that is to say that Judaism is both a set of prescriptions and an ethos, a way of being in the world, a way of holding ourselves. I think probably, honestly, all religious traditions on some level are include that tension, dialectic give and take between, oh, this is what it means to be a Christian. I will give you the following list. And then to say, well, of course, a list. I can't give you a list of what it means to be a Christian. What it means to be a Christian is to embody love. So I think there, the Jewish tradition is too. What does it mean to be a Jew? To walk in God's ways. What does it mean to walk in God's ways? To embody God's love. Okay, well, that's a pretty tall prescription. And that's not about a list that's exhaustible. There's no checklist. Oh, I'm done now. I fulfilled my obligations to God and neighbor. That's not how it works. It's rather an ethos, a way of comporting oneself, if you will.
If you're just joining us, this is Things Not Seen. I'm David Dalt. We're speaking today with Rabbi Shai Held. He's a theologian, educator, and author. He's the president, dean, and chair in Jewish thought at the Hadar Institute in New York City. Today, we're talking about his recent book, Judaism is About Love, Recovering the Heart of Jewish Life. I'm really grateful for where you've brought us here in the conversation, because there's one, I think, reflexive thing that might happen when somebody says Judaism is about love. They ask the great Howard Jones question, that new wave musician from the 1980s, what is love anyway? And you've begun not to define that for us, but rather to help us think about the dynamics of love. And this is something you bring so clearly and deftly into many parts of this book. And I wonder if you can help us to think now, when we talk about a God that loves us, and a God that calls us to love that God and to love each other, help us to begin to think about those dynamics, that ethos that you're talking about. Begin to put some flesh on those bones.
Well, let me start in perhaps in a somewhat boring way, which is to say, love is, I think, a disposition to feel certain ways and to act in certain ways. So I am focused in the book, and I think the tradition is focused not so much on love as an emotion only, but on love as an orientation. I call it an existential posture, a way of holding yourself. Now, you can't hold the existential posture if you never have the emotion, but you can't have the emotion all the time. No one loves all the time. Anyone who has meditated for more than 15 seconds knows that feelings ebb and flow, come and go. You can't build a spiritual life on a feeling. You build a spiritual life on an orientation. Gratitude is very similar. And I think people often get tripped up here, right? You can't feel grateful at every moment, but you can be oriented towards gratitude as a kind of an almost fixed state. So if you say to me, are you feeling grateful at this moment? I might say, no, frankly, I have a headache and I'm feeling crabby. But if you say to me, are you oriented towards gratitude, my aspiration is to say yes, even though I have a headache and I'm feeling crabby. So I think love is similar. It doesn't mean that at every moment I walk around thinking, oh, I just wish the best for everyone I encounter, right? But it does mean that if you ask me, how am I oriented towards other people? The aspiration is I want the good for everyone. I want people to flourish and to thrive. So I think that's important because it's important for a couple of reasons, but one of them is that I think when we describe certain postures like love or gratitude as feelings, we actually invite people to feel terrible about themselves because they can't sustain the feeling all the time. And my point is that's okay. That's what it means to be human and have a human brain and human functionality, right? So instead, let's talk about how we're oriented in the world. Again, it manifests as a feeling. If I never feel compassion, you can question whether I'm oriented towards compassion. But I can be compassionate while right now what I'm feeling is frustrated as opposed to compassionate. Is that clear?
It really is. And what I want my listeners to get from this is that when they come to your book, Judaism is About Love, they are not getting simple Hallmark card answers about these questions, but you delve into the complexity, and it's a complexity that does not simply run on philosophical registers as we're doing right now, but also goes into politics and power dynamics. And one example that was really moving to me was thinking about the way in which a Judaism that has been historically an oppressed class thinks about things like hatred and evil and love versus when Judaism is in the role of having power and access to violence against others. And you say, if I can paraphrase you, we must think differently about hatred and love and evil when there is that difference in power. I wonder if you would say more about that complexity.
Yeah, so let me take it in two directions. First, to talk about the Jewish experience of exile, and then to talk about the Jewish experience of a kind of return to power. One of the most influential Jewish texts of the Middle Ages was a book called The Kuzari by Rabbi Judah Halevi. And one of the things, The Kuzari is a fascinating book, but perhaps the most troubling aspect of that book is the notion that there is an ontological distinction between Jews and non-Jews, something the Bible would have found, which is where we started. The Bible would have found that notion incomprehensible, and to the extent that it understood it at all, it would find it reprehensible. But here's Yehuda Levi saying that Jews have some divine quality that enables them to receive prophecy and other people not. Now, I don't want to apologize for that, but I do think it's important to point out the subtitle of the book, The Kuzari, In Defense of a Despised Religion. Right? What you have there is Yehuda Halevi saying, look, politically, empirically, we are downtrodden and abandoned. But you know what? When it comes to theology and metaphysics, we're something special. Now, when you then shift into a time when you have power, believing that there's an ontological distinction between Jews and Gentiles is very dangerous stuff. And I should say, by the way, the Kabbalistic tradition, the Jewish mystical tradition, is even more worrying in this way, because for all its beauty and its power, it really does insist on some very stark dichotomies, male and female, Jew and non-Jew. And I've argued for many years that the return to power, certainly in the state of Israel, but even on some level, Jews accessing power in the United States means that you have to be careful. What is permitted to be said when you're hurting and downtrodden is not permitted to be said when you, in fact, wield a great deal of power. And I think actually one of the things that parts of the religious Zionist community in Israel have really struggled with is with who is and is not willing to wrestle with the ways in which texts need to be read differently at different times. Even in biblical scholarship, I'm remembering as I'm talking that the Bible scholar Walter Moberly from Durham University in England actually says this is an issue in biblical studies as well, that notions of chosenness and election that are very powerful to people who have no power have to be read much more carefully when those very people do have power. So I think this is always a question. And look, I think also Christians could talk about loving their enemies when they had all the power. The Jews who were reluctant to love their enemies were actually just desperately trying to stay alive. And often, tragically, because they were afraid of Christians who wanted to kill them. So I think it's actually very complicated. I mean, you talk about in the book how I think Judaism's posture about loving enemies is much more complicated than the caricature would suggest. But I do think you always have to think about what is the power situation of the person making a particular claim. By the way, when Christians are downtrodden, they are not always paragons of loving their enemies. And by the way, if Jews were considered the enemies of Christians, Christians did not excel at loving their enemies, to say the least. They killed their enemies just like everybody else.
If you're joining us, this is Things Not Seen. I'm David Dalt. We're speaking today with Rabbi Shai Held. He's a theologian, educator, and author. He's the president, dean, and chair of Jewish thought at the Hadar Institute in New York City. He's the author of Abraham Joshua Heschel, The Call of Transcendence, and The Heart of Torah, a collection of essays on the Torah in two volumes. He lives in White Plains, New York. Today, we're talking about his recent book, Judaism is About Love, Recovering the Heart of Jewish Life. We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to Things Not Seen. I'm David Dalt. Each week on our program, we bring you a rich conversation about culture and faith. If you're enjoying these conversations, please go to our website, thingsnotseenradio.com. There you'll find more than 10 years of these sorts of interviews and conversations, all available for free for your listening pleasure. We're delighted today to be speaking with Rabbi Shai Held. He's a theologian, educator, and author. He's the president, Dean and Chair of Jewish Thought at the Hadar Institute in New York City. He's the author of Abraham Joshua Heschel, The Call of Transcendence, and The Heart of Torah, a collection of essays on the Torah in two volumes. Today we're talking about his recent book, Judaism is About Love, Recovering the Heart of Jewish Life. Well, we've been talking about love in a variety of ways, and in our last segment, you planted your flag. You said, love is not a feeling, love is a disposition. And I would love to begin to bring even more complexity and nuance to that, because one of the things that really stayed with me from reading your book, Judaism is About Love, is the way that you began to think about love and its relationship to human dignity and solidarity, particularly. I wonder if you could begin to talk to us about that.
Yeah, I think an interesting way to get into the love and dignity nexus is to say that there are two fundamental positions in rabbinic tradition about what the guiding principle of the Torah is. One is, as we've mentioned, Rabbi Akiva talking about love your neighbor as yourself. And another, the other, is his colleague, Ben Azai, who thinks that the creation of the human being in God's image, or the descent of the human being from Adam, is the great principle of the Torah. The first one is love. The second, arguably, is dignity. Now, I don't talk about this in the book, but my teacher, Rabbi Yitz Greenberg, actually suggests that the root of dignity in Jewish theology is our belovedness by God. What confers dignity upon us is being loved by God. If I recall correctly, Nicholas Walterstorff makes a similar claim in a Christian context. The notion that actually it's not love or dignity. It's actually dignity rooted in love. And I think the aspiration to love those who have dignity, which is all humanity. I'm talking here about the dignity that is intrinsic to being human, not the dignity of saying, oh, he carries himself with great dignity, but the dignity that comes from that person has infinite dignity by dint of being created in the image of God.
I wanted to ask and clarify about that. So if I'm following, it's because every single person we might encounter, whether a king or a pauper, bears this imago Dei, to use the old language, the image of God, that we are to treat every single one of them as if we were reverencing God, God's self. Now, when I say it that way, does that land right to you, or would you say this in a different way?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. The book of Proverbs actually makes it clear that one who gives a loan to a poor person is giving a loan to God. The way we interact with people is not reflective only of our relationship with God. It is how we interact with God. Just last week, this is not something I talk about in the book. Just last week, I was returning to something I've thought about a lot over the years, which is how in the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 25, a passage that the ending of which is beloved to Christian social justice activists, right? As you have done to the least of these, so have you done to me. Interestingly, most Matthew scholars no longer think that the least of these refers to the poor, but rather refers to Christian missionaries. But be that as it may, it took me a while to realize that Jesus there is riffing on the book of Proverbs, right? When Jesus says, if Jesus means to be talking about the weak and the downtrodden and the vulnerable, when he says, as you have done to the least of these, so have you done unto me, that's exactly what Proverbs says. That's actually, quote unquote, an Old Testament idea. And I think that you have this developed, this is emphasized by various thinkers in the 19th and 20th centuries as well, that there is a kind of nexus between ethics and spirituality, right? What is one of the most fundamental ways that I demonstrate my love for God? By loving God's children. It's not the only way I manifest my love for God. I also pray and I study Torah and I observe the mitzvot in general, not just the interpersonal or ethical ones. But how I treat you is how I treat God. That lies at the very heart of the kind of spirituality and ethics of the Jewish tradition. One of the subtexts of my book that I don't emphasize explicitly, but that I hope will become clear, is that teasing apart theology, spirituality, and ethics is impossible within this tradition. Because I say, I love God, and God says, oh, that's nice, but I love widows and orphans. So how's that going to orient you? Right? So is that theology or ethics? And then I say, oh, I want to cleave to God. And a variety of thinkers say, oh, that's beautiful. You cleave to God by embodying God's compassion. So is that spirituality or is that ethics? Well, yes, right? It's both of those things. And so I think there's something very important there about the kind of seamlessness between the theological, the spiritual, and the ethical. That's something that I think actually Judaism and Christianity share in a very deep way.
We have just reached the most delightful intersection for me because you are now talking very much my language. But now I want to take this and step back and ask a kind of meta level question. All right. So you said earlier in our conversation that it is entirely possible to write a book similar to yours, instead of saying Judaism is about love, Judaism is about hate, or Judaism is about exclusivity, or Judaism. And so my question, is there something that needs to be formed in the believer, the practicer, the reader prior to coming to these texts? Or is there something that comes out of reading these texts that forms the reader? I'm asking a chicken and the egg question. Where does the impetus for ethics, the impetus for love, the impetus for dignity to read these books in this way, where does that come from in this process of engaging with this? Does it come from the community? Does it come from the texts? Is it a gift of God? Help me understand.
Yeah, not only is that a chicken and egg question, it's also an extraordinarily difficult and urgently important one, right? It's really hard. So I'll tell you, one of my great anxieties is that religion is an amplifier. It makes good people better and bad people worse. So you give religion to Osama bin Laden and look at what you get. And you give religion to someone who spends their life caring for the poor and look what you get. So on one level, we can say that very often, it really does matter what we come with. I quote one Israeli scholar who points out that the Torah tells the story of Abraham before the story of Moses. And Abraham doesn't have any law or text to guide him. His ethical intuitions have to come from his ethical intuitions, right? And somehow Abraham is a precursor to Moses because you can learn horrible things from any religious tradition. From the Hebrew Bible, you can learn the need to murder people. From the New Testament, you can learn the need to murder Jews, and on and on and on and on. So I do think it's important that we bring things with us to the reading of the text, and we need to be incredibly mindful and attentive to that, and also extremely careful of who we regard as teachers. Because when you put a tradition in the hands of someone, put it in the hands of the wrong person, and it can become a goad to unfathomably horrible behavior. That said, the discipline of studying Torah in Judaism is supposed to expand the heart. Now, of course, it doesn't empirically always do that any more than reading stories about Jesus necessarily does that. But the aspiration is that it's a kind of virtuous circle where we come with a certain ethical, spiritual orientation. And in turn, the reading and the study deepen and challenge and inspire and goad all of those things, us to become even better. But it is very difficult. And I think it ought to be extremely sobering to all believers, and certainly to those who have a sense of the superiority of faith over non-belief. Really, I would have preferred if Osama bin Laden had been an atheist, because he might have been less violent. I think it's really a hard question that you're asking, and I'm glad you're asking it because it's so important.
Well, and I want to expand on this, and I'm grateful for the graciousness of your answer. I think sometimes Christian listeners to my program, or Christian listeners generally, might have a misapprehension. They tend to look at other religions as just similar in structure, maybe exact in structure to Christianity, only with a deficient object of worship. Whereas when we look at something like Islam or something like Judaism, we're looking at entirely different ways of thinking about right and wrong, and the process of arriving at moral decisions. And this is why I'm so grateful that we started out talking about texts, and we've emphasized the kind of epistemic modesty, the kind of intellectual modesty throughout, is because when we come to the Jewish tradition, and I would invite you to correct me because I do not want to caricature here, we see that the Jewish tradition not only maintained the winners of the arguments, but also maintained the arguments of the losers in the process of compiling the Talmud, and even as we think about it today, because it was so important to demonstrate that this is not simply a matter of checking the boxes of the right answers, but rather when you are in a situation trying to apply these ancient commands from an invisible God, it is going to get complex and messy. In the process of working out that complex messiness, we're going to have different approaches, different momentums, and it is most important that we move carefully and that we move with deliberation. Now, as I've said this, first of all, I want to invite you to correct my characterization. And to the extent that I've got it right, I'd invite you to then talk to us. So what does that tell us about love in this particular moment?
Yeah, so that's really a kind of a set of interesting observations. I think where I would try to grab hold of what you said is that the Jewish tradition, it feels to me, is irreducibly conversational. I never interpret the Torah alone or in a vacuum. I interpret it in a community that has to accept the plausibility of what I'm saying, or I've gone wrong somehow. And that is ideally an enforcing of modesty. Because, oh, guys, I just had the best idea in the world, and that leaves everyone cold. And I realize, well, maybe it wasn't the best idea in the world, right? Then the Talmud is irreducibly that, right? It's conversational, it's debating. And as you say, it preserves minority voices. I think another way of coming at this is to say that the Jewish understanding of covenant has never merely been about obedience. It's always been about dialogue, not just among Jews, but between Jews and God. A text that I think about in my own life often, I don't think I talk about this in the book, but is Psalm 44, which is in many ways the angriest psalm in the Bible. It is a psalm that seemingly is situated after some kind of humiliating military defeat, and the people say to God, "What are you doing? Wake up." And there is something there about the refusal of passivity, the refusal of, oh, whatever happens for the good. We do have those voices in the Jewish tradition too. But we also have the voices that say, no, we are conversation partners here. It's a tradition that imagines that God delights when at times the sages overrule God, right? That's a remarkable way of imagining the divine human relationship. And paradoxically, that kind of reading is not a rebellion against God, but an act of faithfulness towards God. That, I think, is something I'd be curious if, David, I would ask you this question. I've always had the sense that when I've talked to Lutheran audiences, that I'm saying something that sounds Martian to them, because the notion that I'm supposed to read the tradition and then rub up against it and wound both it and myself seems very foreign to them. Is that right?
So I think, and I may be the wrong person to ask this, because I have a sort of thesis that there is both a carceral, a put people in cages momentum in Christianity, and a liberationist momentum in Christianity. And so, depending on who you're talking to, if they lean into the notion that God ultimately is looking to put certain people, however you define that, into cages, whether temporal or eternal, you're going to get a certain reading that says, yeah, and therefore there is one right answer, and you've got one chance to do it. And if you don't, then it's the cages for you. But I'm much more compelled by the spirit that you write about here in your book, Judaism is About Love, that God is forgiving, compassionate. You use the word chesed, God's everlasting love, again and again. And I think of that psalm that basically repeats again and again, God's chesed endures forever. God's chesed endures forever. And that, I think, is a real important piece here. But this brings us back, Rabbi Held, to the fundamental question. If I am loving someone else, there is definitely a story that we tell in our culture that love of someone else means controlling that other person. But what I really like and am excited by is the idea that somehow my love of the other person gives up control over them, and we are then journeying together in greater freedom than we had before. Now, when I say this back to you, am I understanding a central theme of what you're getting at, or would you say this in a different way?
Yeah, no, I think that's right. The Jewish term that I invoke in this context is tzimtzum, or contraction, or I prefer the notion of making space, right? That part of what it means to love someone is to make space for them. An example of this that I love, because I think it's just so clear, is when Martin Buber is young and he writes I and Thou, he begins by talking about how in the beginning was the relation. We are constituted by the kind of relations we have with others. And then when he gets older, he starts talking in a seemingly different register about how the precursor to relationship is what he calls the primal setting at a distance, meaning I have to let you be you and not me in order for us to have a relationship. If you're just an extension of me, then we can't have a relationship. There's just narcissism of my own brain, right? So I sometimes like to joke that often in life, there are two people in a relationship. There's me and there's how you make me feel, right? That's exactly what Buber wants to overcome. He wants there to be a between, right? A space between us such that you and I are both really there. So relationship, and obviously by extension, love, is dependent on making space for humans to be human, for people to be other, for our children not to be extensions of our own ego, for our friends not to be extensions of our own will, for all of that, for our spouse to have different interests, passions, commitments than we do. So it's both a theological idea, we're back to this theology and ethics and spirituality piece, right? It's both a theological idea and an ethical obligation. To love someone is not to dominate them. Love is not dominating or domineering. Love is actually spacious, capacious, making room.
As we're moving to the end of our conversation, your word just now, capacious, your book, Judaism is About Love, is itself a capacious book. It is comprehensive. It is, to quote one of your reviewers for the book, it's magisterial in its scope. And I really appreciate that. As you have been going through this and the effort that it took to bring these ideas to the page, how has your sense of love and loving been shifted by that process?
What a beautiful question. Thank you. I think I would say a couple of things. First of all, and I hope this sounds human rather than pretentious, the process and the project of writing this book was as deep an act of devotion as I've ever engaged in. I felt like this was my attempt to discern what God might mean by love. Now, obviously, again, I'm just one person, and a lot depends on what people hear and what resonates and what doesn't resonate. But that was the kind of what I was trying to do was, how do I hear the Torah? How do I hear God's word in Torah in the broader sense that we talked about earlier? I think also, when I wrote about God's love, it generated for me this really profound spiritual challenge that I sit with all the time now, which is, have I ever really loved the God who loves widows and orphans? What would my life look like if I loved the God who loves widows and orphans, who thinks of widows and orphans, as it were, God's own people? So it is enormously challenging. And one of the things that I think had to struggle with in working on this book is any kind of lofty, aspirational religious teaching has the ability to make us feel terrible about ourselves and has the ability to challenge us, inspire us, move us to try and love more and be more than we've been until now. My hope in writing this for myself was that it was the latter. And my hope is that my readers are challenged, inspired to love just a little more than they can, or than they think they can.
Well, Rabbi Shai Held, I just have to say how grateful I am for your book, Judaism is About Love. I needed this book at this particular moment, and it opened up for me ways of thinking about texts with which I have been wrestling for most of my life. And it helped me to think about neighborliness, especially in a very deep, rich, and complex way. I want to thank you, first of all, for the time and effort that you put into writing this book. It is clear that it is the result of many decades of thought, but I want to thank you especially today for taking the time to talk about it with me and my listeners. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's really been a pleasure.
We've been speaking today with Rabbi Shai Held. He's a theologian, educator, and author. He's the president, dean, and chair in Jewish thought at the Hadar Institute in New York City. He's the author of Abraham Joshua Heschel, The Call of Transcendence, and The Heart of Torah, a collection of essays on the Torah in two volumes. Today, we've been talking about his recent book, Judaism is About Love, Recovering the Heart of Jewish Life. Things Not Seen is produced by Sandberg Media, LLC. We're distributed nationally by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Today's show was recorded at the William Adams Studios in beautiful Hyde Park here on the south side of Chicago, Illinois. Our theme music is composed by Gene Kija. Our show is made possible in part by the generosity of supporters on Patreon. You can find out how to help us create great programs by going to patreon.com/notseenradio. You can follow us on Twitter at @notseenradio. Visit us on Facebook and like our page to receive regular updates about the show and find out more about our guests. That's facebook.com/thingsnotseenradio. And you can sign up for the free podcast, listen to old shows, send us an email, and find out more about our guests if you visit us on the web at thingsnotseenradio.com. I'm David Dalt, and we'll be back next week with more conversations about culture and faith. Please join us.